first case is Locke Realty against U.S. Health. Mr. Maher.
Tim Mayer, along with my co-counsel Alice Springer for the appellant Locke Realty. On September 14, 2009, Judge Miller issued an order, which I'll refer to as the order, which included five issues that we seek to bring before the court this morning. Those five issues are: one, Locke's expert Gene Tipton was excluded when the court determined her opinion was unreliable because it did not employ one of the three accepted methods.
Before we start getting to the merits, counsel, I've got a question about appellate jurisdiction. There are a bunch of appeals here, one of them from a decision that was made in 2006. Now, a notice of appeal filed in late 2011 or early 2012 from a decision made in 2006, one might think, out of time. So we need to know whether there was a motion that would extend the time under Appellate Rule 4A4. I went and looked at the district court's opinions, which are not in the party's appendices. District judges published 14 opinions. Only a few of them are in the party's appendices. And one of them says, with respect to the 2006 judgment, that the judge is rejecting the third motion to alter or amend. Now, given the rule that you can file only one motion to alter or amend with any effect on appellate timing, that suggests we have a problem, doesn't it?
It may indeed, Your Honor, but I believe that the issue that was initially raised in 2006, which was deferred then until later, was the issue of the supplemental award of fees, which the defendants in the case below were appealing, if I'm correct.
I don't see how there can be a supplemental award of fees decided in 2006 before the merits, which were decided in 2011. You don't decide fees questions before merits questions.
There were two cases, Your Honor, which we referred to in the parlance of this matter as Locke 1 and Locke 2. Locke 1 was resolved with an entry of judgment, the stipulated entry of judgment, because the matter was resolved, and then because of the defendant's failure to abide by the terms of the agreement, a stipulated judgment was entered. A fee award was entered, and the court deferred then the addition of fees on that issue until after Locke 2, which had come into being by that time, had occurred.
You're still not engaging my initial question, which is how there can be an appeal in 2011 or 2012 from a judgment entered in 2006.
I don't believe the final judgment was entered until
after. The judgment entered in 2006 is a final judgment. It is take nothing. It's a classic take nothing judgment. Plaintiff loses. That's as final as they come.
I'm not familiar with that judgment, Your Honor.
Yes, I know. That's part of the problem. The parties seem to have just assumed that whatever they're appealing from, there must be jurisdiction. There's no serious discussion of that issue in the briefs. The appendices to the briefs don't have the materials essential to track it down. I asked my law clerks to look into it. They couldn't make head nor tail of it. It's perfectly clear that absolutely essential documents have been omitted from your appendices.
And for that, I offer my apologies to the court, but I believe that the issues that we do seek to appeal are those.
One doesn't appeal issues. One appeals judgments.
And the judgment that we're seeking to appeal was not entered until July of 2011, I believe, Your Honor. That's the judgment that.
I will give both sides some time to file supplemental memos. But if we have to go by what's in the briefs, at least one, maybe two of these three appeals are going to have to be dismissed. Maybe there's something that's not in the briefs, but we're going to have to go beyond what you provided us.
I appreciate the court's indulgence in that matter. and we'll be happy to provide whatever supplementation we're capable of doing, which would hopefully clear this matter up for the court. Also, having been engaged in this matter for the past 7 years, Your Honor, I'm familiar with the Gordian knot aspects of it, which tend to make things transverse and less than a straight line. The five issues that I wanted to address with the court included, one, the exclusion of Jean Tipton on the Daubert analysis that claimed she did not use one of the three accepted methods for determining the fair market value of the Goshen facility, which is what, in the parlance of this case, we started calling the facility, which is the subject of the lease agreement. So when you're reviewing the record in the case, it will be helpful for you to know that's what that is. She found the fair market value to be $55,000 a month. Because Tipton's opinion was excluded, the summary judgment that was filed by Locke was also denied. For the reasons that we think the exclusion was improper, we think that the motion for summary judgment was proper and should have been granted, or at least should have been heard.
Why do you think an unaccepted offer is evidence of fair market value?
I think that the fair market value does require what the analysis should be what a willing seller and a willing buyer would agree upon. Now,
right. So an unaccepted offer, which are the two that she pointed to, don't tell you anything, really, do they?
Indeed, they do, Your Honor. They tell you what a willing buyer.
No, but I mean,
they tell you the minimum.
They tell you the right, maybe a floor, but you know, if A owns a house that's assessed by the tax assessor at $200,000, and B comes along and offers $150,000 for it, A is likely to turn down that offer as being really awfully far out of line to what A reasonably thinks the house is worth.
True enough. But
and so there's, I mean, so the $150,000 tells you nothing.
Yeah, it's kind of like saying the value of a painting is the price offered in the very first bid in an auction. That's not informative. You need to know the final bid in the auction, not the first bid.
And while that may be true, and I concede that it would be in terms of determining what the fair market value of that painting might be, what we had in this instance and what we think is unique to the case and which should affect the Daubert analysis is, rather than having evidence of what other properties were bought or sold for or leased for, we have actual offers on the subject property, which we think makes this somewhat
unique. But they're unaccepted. I mean, if the subject property had sold, you know, recently for an amount, if there was something to give you fair market value, that would be one thing. But I found this completely worthless. And I don't think your problem really was that your expert didn't use one of the three methods that the district court recognized were tried and true, so to speak. It's also that she didn't offer any other method that was equally valid. So I have to say, I wasn't impressed by what she did suggest.
And that's a problem with which I'll contend. But even back to Daubert, Your Honor, the court says that even shaky expert testimony should be allowed and subjected to the...
No, not if the methodology is worthless and if you think things are evaluated simply by what some buyer wants to suggest without any indication that that's a fair market value. I don't think you have any support for that.
There were other indications that there was fair market value, and that's the IAC calculation, which is a stat. The Indiana Administrative Code sets forth a calculus for determining, among other things, the fair market value of a facility that's in the Medicaid program, such as this one.
Why is that a measure of fair market value? Some government subsidy program says we will count X as a cost. What does a subsidy program have to do with the fair market value of anything?
Because the vast majority of the beds in the Goshen facility were enrolled in that program, and so that was the governing value for the actual facility.
No, look, it's not a governing value. You could show, perhaps, by a survey of actual selling prices in markets, what the correlation was between the value allowed in a regulatory cost calculus and the actual purchase and sale value of properties, right? One could study that as an empirical matter. But I gather that your expert didn't study that as an empirical matter.
I believe what my expert did was value the business as it existed. I don't know that she...
Did your expert try to calculate what the correlation was between the amount allowed as a cost in this Medicaid program and the actual purchase and sale price of nursing homes?
Of other nursing homes? I don't believe she did, Your Honor.
And that's the point. I mean, you know, you have... Actually, if you study the entire deregulation movement, it's all about the discrepancy that the Chief Judge is talking about, that regulated prices may reflect what the regulators want them to reflect, but they're not necessarily the prices that the market would come up with.
Our hope was, Your Honor, that we'd be eliminating the variable of arguing the similarity of other properties to the property at issue in this case by using, among other things, the admission by Mr. Bartle. One of the offers was from one of the named defendants in this matter who was trying to renegotiate the lease he was currently bound by.
But, of course, everybody's got funny incentives. You were trying to show a very low fair market value for this purpose. Otherwise, you would have liked the value of the lease to be as high as possible because that's the money that was going to come to you. He had similarly conflicting incentives. That's why... Mm-hmm. These three conventional methods, comparisons between the subject property and other similar property and so on, or an income-based thing or a net return basis, are at least three ways that are regarded as reliable.
They are, but there it is to be a flexible analysis in a unique situation such as this where
this
we have...
I don't understand why you keep saying this is unique. It seems to me this would be quite commonplace if somebody has a debate about value.
In many of the value cases cited by my opponents, Your Honor, they're talking about condemnation or cases where there are even statutory requirements that you go out and find comps and submit those to, in order to define this fair market value. We didn't have that situation. What we had was a situation in which we'd had an attempt to renegotiate by one of the defendants, and our expert thought that was worthy of being used in attempting to assess the fair market value of the property at issue. I see that my light is lit, and I'm burning the rest of my time, and I have at least four other issues. Thanks.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Palmer.
May it please the court. I'm going to try to shed a little bit of light on the jurisdictional issue that Your Honor raised. Lock 1, to which Mr. Mayor referred to, was a case in which there was a stipulated judgment back in, I believe it was 2005. And then ultimately, the district court granted a request for attorney's fees of approximately $86,000 in 2012, I believe, or 2011. That is separate and distinct from the summary judgment. And that's the case we appealed on the issue of attorney's fees. Locke has not appealed that. Locke 2, well, Your Honor is correct that there was a summary judgment entered against the plaintiffs in 2006. There remained an issue of AmeriCare's set-offs against what they had received as a summary judgment for past due rent, which was approximately $371,000. Those set-off issues were tried in a one-day bench trial to the court, and the district court entered a judgment in favor of Locke and against AmeriCare on July 22, 2012. And I believe Locke did timely file a notice of appeal from that judgment, and at that point, we filed a cross motion, a cross notice of appeal having to do with...
You don't mean July 22nd, 2012. That
I'm sorry,
was just
I'm
two
sorry,
months
Your Honor.
Ago.
July 22nd, 2010. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor, for pointing it out. And then we filed the cross notice of appeal on the issue of the attorney's fees. So there was a continuing litigation after the summary judgment.
I hope you appreciate the problem that I raised with Mr. Mayer, which is under the rules, the time to appeal is affected by only one post-judgment motion. And your narrative, and in fact the narrative in your brief, discusses several, and the district court mentioned three. That seems more than one.
It's obviously not very correct, Your Honor, that three is more than one.
And isn't that problematic?
To the extent, Your Honor, that there was a judgment entered July 22, 2010, that disposed of all of the issues in the case except the issue of attorney's fees, it was my understanding that that was the final judgment in the case. And then when the attorney's fees order came down...
I think that we are going to need supplemental memos from the parties.
Perfectly fine, Your Honor. We'll be happy to.
With some attention to the rules of law, the narrative in both your brief and Mr. Mayer's brief makes no effort to correlate the statements to the actual rules of appellate procedure, Rule 4A4 in particular, that will determine which post-judgment motions extend the time for appeal.
And we'll be happy to do that, Your Honor. With respect to the merits of the appeal, as Judge Wood, you pointed out, the unaccepted offers were obviously low-ball offers from people who were trying to...
I don't know whether that's obvious or not. I mean, I think your point is we just don't know anything these were opening offers. They might have been perfectly, for all we know, they were the bidder's reservation price.
Your Honor, I'll agree with that. The only solid evidence we have of what the fair rental value was is what AmeriCare was paying under the lease at that time, and that was approximately $93,000 a month. And Ms. Tipton's opinion that the fair rental value was $55,000 a month is based only on the two unaccepted offers and the Medicaid reimbursement regulations, which they contend she simply plugged numbers in to that formula and pulled out what the fair reimbursement amount was. The problem with that is that we don't know what numbers she plugged in. Nowhere does she disclose what the components of the formula were for her to reach her opinion. And that is a bottom line number. We don't know how she did it. And as this court is well aware, bottom line conclusions are not acceptable methodologies under Daubert. Aside from the fact that the district court correctly determined that Ms. Tipton's methodologies were not reliable and properly excluded her testimony and her opinion, thereby rendering summary judgment in favor of AmeriCare proper because they had no expert witness to testify as to future rental value, the district court's judgment, a summary judgment against Locke, is also supported by the liquidated damages theory. The lease agreement provided for liquidated damages consisting of retaining the escrow accounts, the security deposit and replacement reserves that had been deposited by AmeriCare with Locke when the lease was initiated. In answers to interrogatories where we requested information about what those amounts were at that time, because they were going to be used to set off, or we were going to use those to set off any future damages, Locke responded, "It's irrelevant. Those are liquidated damages. It doesn't matter what they are. They're ours now. You forfeited them." That was in their answers to interrogatories. At that point, we contend that Locke elected its remedies of liquidated damages as opposed to trying to prove actual damages for future lost rent. And the cases we cited in our brief establish that liquidated damages and actual damages are inconsistent and mutually exclusive.
Well, doesn't that depend on the contract? I mean, people could write contracts however they wish.
Your Honor, there are cases out there. There is one case specifically out of Wisconsin in which the contract provided further coverage of both liquidated damages and actual damages, and the court found that that was ambiguous because generally you can't do that. Generally you can't cover liquidated damages and actual damages. And the Wisconsin court remanded the case to the trial court to determine what the intent of the parties was. We don't have that situation in this case, Your Honor, because the contract language does not specifically say you can recover both. It says that Locke can retain, at its option, can retain the escrow accounts and the security deposit. Locke exercised its option to do so. So there's nothing ambiguous about that. The contract does not say you can exercise your option and also recover future rental. So for that reason, we believe that the district court's order granting summary judgment in favor of AmeriCare is supported on that ground also. I would like to get into our appeal, our cross appeal, on the issue of attorney's fees. As we've made clear during the argument, that there were two cases, Lock 1 and Lock 2. Lock 1 resulted in a consent judgment in favor of Lock for $485,000, approximately $500.
So the problem I had with most of your discussion of attorney's fees is this. You did make a certain number of specific objections to the fees that Locke was requesting, and the district court appears to have accepted a great number, if not all, of your specific objections. And that's the way this is supposed to work. The billing records consume this much space if you stack them up, and you seem to be criticizing the court for not taking your general exception and wading through every last one of these entries to see which ones should be acceptable and which ones shouldn't. And that's just not the law. You have to, I mean, onerous though it may be, you've got to point out specifically to the district court which things you think are inappropriate.
Your Honor, I understand that our general objection was that a general objection to...
It was, and the district court accepted your specific ones, cut back in a number of respects.
And our criticism of the district court was not in not wading through those entries on its own. Our criticism of the district court is in the fact that the district court did not put the burden back on them to explain those block billings.
It's because he thought you didn't satisfy your initial burden of pointing to the particular entries that you thought were objectionable.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I agree that the vast number of these entries provided so little information that we couldn't identify if the entries were related to a new management contract or to a new organization.
So you needed to say so. I flipped through quite a few of them just to get some sense of it. And, you know, maybe it would have been a long motion, but if that's really what you thought, some of them seem perfectly comprehensible to me. Maybe not all. But I just think that the way this has to work for the sake of the district court's sanity is you've got to tell the judge which ones you think are objectionable.
And I appreciate that, Your Honor. And we did, in fact, try to tell the judge the ones that we could make the specific objections to.
Mm-hmm.
However, we also included that general saying we can't tell, and asking the court to make them come back and tell us, break it down, and provide us with the information.
But did that apply to all 400 whatever pages? I didn't bring it with me, but...
I believe it was 283 pages or something in that. Yes, Your Honor, it did, because we looked at them and we simply couldn't tell. Aside from the specific objections, though, Your Honor, there's also the proposition under Indiana law that if there's a complaint filed on a contract, And a counterclaim is also filed that the attorney's fees awarded under the contract are to be reduced in proportion to whatever is recovered on the counterclaim. And the district court in this case did not do that. If the district court had done that, the attorney's fees would have been reduced depending on...
So where's your precedent in Indiana law for some rule that says the district court has to reduce the aggregate fees by some percentage?
The law is in... we've cited in our... Burris v. Canal Construction and Design Company, citing the Arizona case. It's on cited on pages 36 and 37 of our brief. It doesn't say you have to do it by a specific percentage. The law is that if you do recover on the counterclaim, the attorney's fees awarded on the original contract sued upon by the plaintiff is reduced in proportion to what is recovered on the counterclaim. In this case, if you take just the net award of damages given to Locke and not...
I'm not sure your numbers are... I mean, there are a lot of ways to play with these numbers. Locke collected a lot of money because they did have their back rent. They had their security deposit, the escrow amount. I mean, you can fool around with these numbers in a number of different ways.
You can, Your Honor. And we gave the court two optional numbers based on whether or not the escrow accounts were considered or not. If you base the reduction solely on what they recovered as a net judgment, the attorney's fees should be reduced by 33.4%.
But this is abuse of discretion review. We don't micromanage the way the district court judge handles attorney's fees. I mean, this litigation, I have to say, really went out of control. And it seems to me, you know, the district judge had his hands full trying to manage it on all sides.
I agree with that, Your Honor. It did go out of control. It went out of control because of the numerous motions that were filed for summary judgment on both sides. It was not the fault of any one side or the other. And that obviously racked up the attorney's fees. But this is a case that's governed by Indiana law. This case and the district court sat on diversity. And under Indiana law, the damages have to be reduced in proportion to what's recovered on the counterclaim. And the district court simply did not do that in this case. But going back to the percentages, if you consider what they retained on the escrow accounts and security deposit as their gross judgment, the reduction should be 12.4% or approximately $86,350. If you consider only what they actually recovered, which was contested. The security deposit and the escrow accounts were never contested, but if you consider what their net judgment was, their attorney's fees should be reduced by 33.4% or roughly $232,600. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Anything further, Mr. Mayor?
Yes, sir.
The summary judgment issue regarding the denial of the granting of the defendant's motion for summary judgment based on the absence of evidence is affected not just by the Tipton denial, but also the fact that the evidence that was in the record at the time included the admission by John Bartle that a fair market value of that lease was $65,000 per month. So the fact that we lost the summary judgment on the absence of evidence when there was, in fact, evidence in the record, we believe that we should at least have the opportunity to have that determined on the merits. There was also then the issue of the supplemental report that we sought to have admitted in the case because during the 791 days that our summary judgment motion was pending, an audit and a Medicaid audit occurred, which generated a report which determined, among other things, a fair rental value of this facility.
So how often is the district court required, in your view, to reopen the evidence? Because obviously if he'd let in your supplemental evidence, it would have only been fair to have allowed the other side to come back and respond somehow, and then maybe another 6 months floats by and somebody else comes up with more evidence. Doesn't the district judge have discretion to just say we're done?
I believe the district judge does have that, Your Honor. However,
and that's the discretion he exercised in the case of your supplemental filing.
Indeed. But in this specific instance, the motion had been timely filed and was pending for quite some period of time.
Well,
this event occurred.
Doesn't require the district judge to extend the time even further.
It doesn't.
By allowing your supplemental evidence in.
It doesn't. But as the case occurred, Rule 56F at the time did permit for there to be targeted discovery, and the ruling did not occur until some 11 months later.
I'm not sure you're answering the question. I mean, it sounds to me like you're conceding the district judge does have discretion, and you might not like the way he exercised it here, and it's too bad this motion, which you repeatedly say in your brief, was pending for 791 days. But there was a lot going on in this case, and the judge was trying to move the case forward.
That's true. And what I'm saying is that had he exercised his discretion the other way, and I acknowledge that the judge has that, there is a set rule there for how that is to occur. And on the facts of the case as they unfolded, it would not have impacted, as far as we can tell, the outcome, because there was still 11 months left before the determination was ultimately made.
Well, but that's an ex post perspective. It seems to me this type of evidence in particular is not the sort of thing that you could only have found after time. You could have put in a better set of data about what the fair market value was at the outset, as we discussed earlier. And I guess I'm reluctant to say that a district judge faced with a difficult case like this one can't say enough is enough, I'm not extending the time.
And I have to concede, Your Honor, that he does have that level of discretion. However, then what happened was we submitted it in our motion for supplementation. We said it also supports the Tipton opinion because it provides it's people generated by people who are from the same discipline and is in fairly agreement with what she calculated. As it turns out, then Ms. Tipton's opinion is rejected, and we think that the Daubert analysis may have shifted with respect to the fourth Daubert criteria.
But once a judge decides he's not going to consider a piece of evidence, he's not going to consider it. Again, if he had allowed that to come in, then surely U.S. Health would have come back with whatever they might have wanted to come back with. It's impossible to unravel this the way you want to.
I guess, again, it may be possible to unravel it the way that I wanted to. It didn't happen that way.
Right.
And we think that that ruling, then taken in conjunction with the following ruling, which is having to do with the set-off, and to be clear, the case law that Mr. Palmer's side refers to with respect to the fee award and the effect of a counterclaim, there was no counterclaim in this case. The order that Judge Miller entered on September the 14th, 2009, allowed them a set-off, which they had not ever pled, which they were under an order saying that they had waived, and then 17 months later he let it in.
He said that you were perfectly aware from the very start that they were trying to set this off. I don't want to go through all the sites, but
I don't believe
they'd been talking about set-off for a long time. Now, whether we want to delve into the English common law of set-offs and counterclaims and the like is probably not necessary here. But
I didn't find that particularly helpful. But to the extent that they're relying on law that says their success in their counterclaim does in fact impact their ability to affect the claim recovery or the fee recovery that we make, I think it's important to recognize that there was no counterclaim in this case. Also, the fact that this was let in and Judge Miller then created essentially anew, there was no rule, as there would be under Rule 56F, to permit us to supplement when he re-enervated this
but
settlement.
In your 2006 summary judgment filings, you had acknowledged U.S. Health's intention to argue for a set-off.
Your Honor, what we said was that the defendants effectively seek to win an affirmative defense which they have yet to plead. We didn't extensively brief it. We noted
pleadings are supposed to get the case rolling, though. Once the court has moved on, the entire thrust of the pleading rules is to make sure everybody has notice of what's going on, help the case get structured. I think to fixate on what a complaint or an answer says in light of modern federal civil procedure is not entirely right.
There was no answer, however. At the time that these motions were pending, the time that our motions were filed, and even after they responded to our second motion for partial summary judgment, no answer had been filed. The document that they filed, they did denominate an answer. They later claim and continue to claim, I think, to this day, that it's an amended answer, although it was never denominated as such. No motion to amend was made. But that had never been filed. And each time that they argued that in response to a motion for summary judgment, we, as the court points out in its September 14, 2009 order, reminded the defendants of their obligation to file these and noted that they had not. And that's the extent of the response we made. We did not make a full-blown response, Your Honor, to a claim that was not before us or the court. I see that my time is over. If no one has any further questions.
Thank you very much. The court directs the parties to file supplemental memoranda concerning appellate jurisdiction. The memoranda are due within 14 days. When they're received, the case will be taken under advisement.